This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. In March of 2006, Mohammad Tahereh Azhar drove a rented SUV through the campus of his alma mater, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Several people were hurt, though none seriously. In his confession to police, Tahereh Azhar said he hoped to kill as many people as possible in order to avenge the deaths of Muslims worldwide and punish the United States government. He said he was aiming to follow in the footsteps of one of his role models, 9/11 hijacker Mohammed Atta. Charles Kurzman is a professor of sociology at the UNC Chapel Hill, and he wondered why there aren't more attacks like Tahereh Azhar's. If terrorism is as easy as renting a car, or in this country, buying a gun, why aren't there more Mohammed Tahereh Azhar's? His new book is called The Missing Martyrs, Why There Are So Few Muslim Terrorists. Charles Kurzman is with me in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks very much for having me.
You begin the book with the story of Mohammed Tahereh Azhar. Talk about why this is illuminating for you.
Well, the first most striking thing for me personally is that he drove his car right past my office on that day in 2006. And I think his attack brought home to me and to many folks here in North Carolina this phenomenon, this global phenomenon, a phenomenon of terrorism that otherwise might seem distant and a problem in other places. But the other thing that was striking for me, since I've been following Islamic revolutionary movements throughout my academic career, is the dispersion of these methods. It's no longer a matter just of getting to a training camp or joining a large militant group, but any individual who wants to is being called upon by these revolutionaries to go engage in violent terrorist activities. And it's as easy, as you said, it's as easy as getting behind the wheel and driving up onto the curb and calling it terrorism. And yet, we don't see very many people doing it. And so I started to wonder, well, how many acts of terrorism are there in the world? And there are databases of this. How many folks are there in the United States engaging in this kind of activity? And why aren't more folks getting involved in this? What is stopping people? And what is stopping Muslims in particular who are being recruited actively on the internet by all sorts of revolutionary organizations affiliated with Al-Qaeda and otherwise? And yet they're saying no, they're not getting involved.
Well, and as you point out in the book, Mohammed Tahereh Azhar used the internet to get some of his ideas. Those very suggestions are there on these templates for how to be a good terrorist.
Exactly. He never went overseas. He never went to any training camp. He simply downloaded stuff on the internet, and it's all too simple to do that. And just about everybody in this country has access. If they wanted to look it up, if they wanted to act on it, they could. Now, some of these plots, I want to mention, are being stopped by law enforcement. And so we want to give credit to law enforcement for doing a good job in a difficult situation where they don't know where the next threat is coming from. Now, some of the cases we've seen seem to have been sort of ginned up by law enforcement, where they're the ones who put the idea in the folks' head. But other cases, clearly, were going to be violent incidents, and we're fortunate that law enforcement does a good job. But the number of arrests we're seeing and disrupted plots that we're seeing is still relatively small. We're talking about a Muslim population in this country of more than 2 million folks, and yet the number of people getting involved in these plots is minuscule. We're talking about 20 a year, and most of those have targets overseas and have been disrupted at very early stages. In other words, they're not particularly competent terrorists, fortunately for the rest of us.
So what are you finding? Why are there so few?
Well, the easy answer is that most Muslims aren't interested in violent revolution. Most Muslims are engaged in ordinary life like other folks. They want the best for their family. And there's also a strong commitment to the values of democracy and liberal ideals of pluralism and tolerance. We see that among Muslims as we do among other folks. And so we see both the ends and the means, a strong pushback from Muslim communities. If we look at, for example, Muslim leaders, both in the United States and around the world, they've spoken out repeatedly against terrorism. This is not like a fringe idea. The mainstream of Muslim opinion believes that these terrorist activities are un-Islamic and they don't want to have anything to do with them. And so we see a major disappointment even on the part of the revolutionaries who are complaining constantly on their websites. what's wrong with you Muslims? Why aren't you waking up? Why aren't you joining us? They're having trouble recruiting and they're upset about it.
Well, they're having some trouble, but the fact is that there are successful and growing militant movements abroad. Al-Shabaab in Somalia, certainly in occupied territories. We're seeing some kinds in some places. Militant movements are, in fact, on the rise, or at least very, very healthy. Just not here, and maybe that's just because of real good enforcement, not only in arresting people, but in discouraging anybody from getting started. It's good law enforcement.
You make a good point, and I think that I don't mean to overgeneralize. There are some places around the world where terrorism and Islamic revolutionary terrorism is a serious problem, and you mentioned Somalia. We could also mention Afghanistan and Pakistan and Yemen. But those are places with civil conflicts, ongoing revolutionary movements that are quite widespread and serious civil conflict. The rest of the world, according to data from the National Counterterrorism Center, has experienced a decline in terrorism over the last few years. And terrorism is not a particularly deadly form of violence. It's not as widespread as many other forms of violence in almost every country around the world, those handful of civil conflicts excepted. So it's not just the United States. Now, also, law enforcement has been aggressive all around the world, so there's no major distinction there. But the globally, as well as in the United States, outside of these handful of areas, fortunately, the world didn't see this explosion of terrorism that we were bracing ourselves for in the days and the months after 9/11.
You mentioned the fact that the media can inadvertently become accomplices in terrorism. What do you mean?
Terrorists, unlike most murderers, are not just trying to intimidate the people they're attacking. They're also trying to intimidate and cause fear and terror among other audiences. And the media, sadly, but this is built into the way the media works, by reporting on these activities, brings the news about them to other folks who wouldn't otherwise never know about it. As a result, you get widespread fear just because journalists are doing their job. If they didn't do their job, if they didn't report on these things, there would simply be a local effect. We expect the news media to do this. We expect them to do this reporting. And yet the flip side of it is we end up getting this distorted image of how prevalent terrorist violence is. And the terrorists themselves know this, and they are media savvy, at least the most successful ones, and they engage in the types of actions in the types of locations where they know there'll be maximum media attention.
So if publicity encourages terrorism, let's again go back to the enforcement side. What about the argument that are checking some of our civil liberties at the door, CIA black sites, rendition, waterboarding, torture, all of those things that have, liberals have complained about have in fact been very effective at stemming the tide of terrorism because it scares them and they don't want to do it and we're keeping them off our streets.
It's unclear from the evidence whether those things are working, whether they're creating more revolutionaries or whether they're discouraging them. And since, keep in mind, these are folks who have claimed that they're willing to give their lives for their cause, the idea that they might be discomfited along the way by our policies shouldn't be a major deterrent, according to the logic of these things. It's unclear whether our policies matter much for these really committed revolutionaries and what the balance is between people that were triggering into that level of revolutionary activism and the folks we're deterring from it.
So you're saying on the one hand, we're proving their point when they go to recruit, see these Americans, they're barbarians. And on the other hand, who's afraid of dying when being a martyr is in fact the goal? So those are two points that you make. Another point that you make is some of our fear about growing radicalism really comes from and you make a nice play on words here, radical chic, a play on radical chic, of course. Thomas Wolfe's famous phrase, you spell it S-H-E-I-K, talk about radical chic and kind of being cool and being militant.
Yeah, it's a bad pun, I admit.
I like it.
Thanks. the idea is that there is out there some sympathy for Al-Qaeda, for bin Laden, this idea of being anti-imperialist and standing up to the West. But frequently, when we see this on internet bulletin boards and so on, it's being expressed by folks who in their other postings are saying how much they like music, and they're showing pictures of themselves wearing Western style clothing, or you know, not covering their hair if they're female, and wearing short skirts, suggesting that these are not folks who are actually about to sign up for an Islamic revolutionary movement and wouldn't actually want to see one come into power where they're living. I suggest that there's a sort of coolness about it. It's like a fad. And the analogy that I draw is to Che Guevara. So we still see on college campuses young people with Che Guevara T-shirts and posters and so on. They have very little knowledge of what Che Guevara's ideology was, which was a Stalinist socialist revolutionary movement. And I don't think they would have much sympathy for it if they knew. And yet it's cool. It's standing up to the establishment. And to some extent, somebody wearing a Bin Laden T-shirt is making the same kind of symbolic statement that is separate from any kind of revolutionary actual activism.
So are we making too much of a terrorist threat?
I think we should have our discussion about terrorism based on the evidence of the actual number of incidents, the ones that have been foiled, and the actual attacks that we've seen. And after 9/11, we set up a security system domestically and globally that was designed to withstand an escalation of terrorist violence. Now, we've been fortunate that that hasn't occurred to the extent that we feared. And so maybe it's time now to rethink this, now that a decade or more has passed, to rethink this and switch the dial slightly. We're not talking about all or nothing, all security and no freedom, or all freedom and no security. We're talking about shades of gray and moving the dial slightly. And let's move that dial and have a public debate about that based on the evidence rather than based on our fears and paranoia.
And you say one of the ways that we can improve the debate is to pay a little more attention to the kind of discourse that's going on in Muslim countries about the very things that we're discussing here.
Absolutely. Muslim communities, both in the United States and around the world, are very much debating what's the right balance between security and freedom. And the different communities may come up with different answers. And of course, there's disagreement within every community. But the idea that every Muslim is a potential terrorist is so dangerous, both for security purposes, because it leads us to spend our security resources unwisely and waste them on a lot of folks who are not security threats, which means we're going to be overlooking other sorts of dangers. It's also unwise because it violates our values. It violates our values of pluralism, of toleration, of more than toleration, of appreciation of difference. And I think when we get into this mindset of worrying about the terrorist, you know, around next door, then we do things we won't be proud of later.
So that's the impact on U.S. public opinion. And you also talk about Muslim public opinion in various places, or the opinions in various Muslim countries. And you describe it as being, with regard to the U.S., inelastic. What do you mean?
Yeah, that's an economics term. It suggests that the demand for something doesn't go up and down all that much when the price goes up and down. And I believe that Muslim publics, and there's some evidence for this from survey results over the last 20 years, Muslim publics don't change their view of America all that much when U.S. policy changes. It's, in other words, Muslim consumption of American foreign policy is inelastic. So when we do things that help Muslims, for example, helping the Bosniaks in the 1990s, Bosniak Muslims, we didn't get a whole lot of credit for it among many Muslim publics. And when we invaded Muslim-majority countries after 9/11, most countries, their attitudes towards us didn't change. The negatives were already so high, they didn't have much higher to go. Now, there are a couple countries where attitudes towards America do vary based on our policy, places like Turkey and Indonesia in particular. But in most countries, it seems pretty stable. But within that, if we unpack what anti-Americanism means, it has to do with U.S. foreign policy and much less to do with the values that we share. People in surveys show, and political movements that are popular in Muslim-majority countries, show that they share very much about our American values of freedom, of democracy, of free speech, of value on education, a value on family. There's lots of shared material there, and that doesn't change either when U.S. foreign policy changes.
Well, so, I mean, then it suggests that maybe we can just stay on the same course and not have much impact in terms of our safety internationally.
That's true, but I think we can do better. And I think we can do better by looking at what our allies in Muslim-majority societies would like us to do and taking that into account. If those are the folks ultimately we're trying to help, then unilaterally deciding what we're going to do over there to help them isn't, I think, as strategic as asking them, what do you think we should be doing to help you? And now those may be things, their suggestions may be things we don't particularly want to do, but at least they should have a voice in this decision-making process, even though they may not be U.S. citizens and voting for our elected leaders.
So as a sociologist, what do you make of what appears to be American inelasticity with regard to Muslims and their opinion about who Muslims are and what they stand for?
American opinion has changed somewhat over the last decade. So there's been surveys about opinions about Islam and Muslims. And the big difference was that the people who said don't know, and when they were asked about their attitudes towards Islam and Muslims, went way down. But it was distributed in both directions, so more favorables and more unfavorables. But an interesting thing is how you word the question matters a lot. If you ask, are you favorable about Islam, the unfavorables are slightly higher than the favorable responses. But if you ask, what do you think about Muslims, the favorable responses outnumber the unfavorable by 2-1. Mm. People are much more happier to say they're favorable on actual people than on somebody else's faith.
So what do you hope people take away from your book?
I'd like to see us turn down the volume on paranoia and fear in these discussions of security and discussions of Islam and Muslims in the United States, and see if we can't have a reasonable discussion about policies on these topics based on evidence instead of based on stereotypes.
Charles Kurzman, always a pleasure. Thanks
Thank
for being
much.
On the program. Charles Kurzman's a professor of sociology at the UNC Chapel Hill, and he is the author of The Missing Martyrs, Why There Are So Few Muslim Terrorists. And that's the state of things for today. Thank you for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio, which is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.